Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Book Spider podcast. This is a Book of the Week style podcast in which we analyze the theme and craft of a chosen text or set of texts for each episode. This week, we're discussing The Power and the Glory, the 1940 novel by Graham Greene. My name is Chris Malmberg, and I'm joined by my co-hosts Patrick Barney and Hans Berger. Welcome, and I hope you enjoy this episode as much as we will enjoy it. Recording it. Graham Greene lived in Mexico for several months in 1938 to research and write about the persecution of Catholic priests that had reached its peak earlier in that part of the decade. He wrote several nonfiction pieces and a couple years later published the novel we're discussing today. The Power and the Glory follows an unnamed whiskey priest as he makes his way through the state of Tabasco, where Catholicism was so illegal that priests were hunted down and executed by the police. He may be the last priest in the region who has neither renounced nor been killed. The action moves through a series of vignettes in which the priest, who is an outlaw, tries to evade the pursuit of the law. While there is a plot, I think that functions mainly as a lattice for the interesting conversations he has with various figures along the way and repeated opportunities for him to fail his own ecclesiastical standards. He considers himself a shitty priest and a coward, and mostly he's probably right. Pursuing him is the lieutenant, a man driven by intense hatred for the church, and priests specifically, who he sees as parasites on the common people of Mexico. The lieutenant is nonetheless a very complicated figure, showing on several occasions that he is neither heartless nor corrupt. The story culminates in the priest's capture, to which he submits himself, apparently willingly. He appears to know that the story of a dying man requesting last rites is a ruse, but goes anyway and finds the lieutenant waiting. What follows is a series of conversations between the priest and the lieutenant about the true function of priests, who offer no real avenues of improvement in the lives of their parishioners, just the unprovable promise of salvation after life ends. This, despite the very real disparities that their parishioners, largely poor, face. The lieutenant seems to revise his impression of the priest as a man, but to continue in his belief that priests in general are not good for society. And so the priest is executed. And I did a little bit of kind of digging around to, do a little bit of research on this book, in part because it's actually 80 years since it came out, or as we discussed before, going on 90 years. That's a little private joke for Patrick, who's not going on 50. I came across, a few things and mostly didn't find too much to build on. I just found kind of one paragraph that I thought was kind of a good sort of like broad foundation on which to kind of like launch an analysis of this novel. And that's from Roman Azzopardi's essay, The Motif of Daughters in Power and the Glory. That came out in 1980. As a party writes, the priest's interactions convey Graham Greene's view of human experience as being that of a wandering soul battling to embrace faith and regain grace in a world that is either hostile or indifferent. And I think that is pretty true. I think that's a pretty accurate, not like super, I think it's not like twisting or being super creative in its interpretation of the novel or its themes, but I think it's a good accurate place from which to start. And I think it's also important for that reading that the whiskey priest is such a pathetic coward throughout, because he's no martyr. He's not heroic in any way. He's kind of feckless. He's an every man who nonetheless takes his faith too seriously to save himself. Unless maybe you read the knowing march at the end to his own death as a desperate attempt to save his own soul. He's really well drawn. He's very interesting, but I'm not too compelled to talk about the priest. Actually, I'm much more compelled to talk about the lieutenant, and maybe we'll circle back around to the priest anyway. But I'm really, really fascinated by the lieutenant, in part because he doesn't seem to fit too cleanly into the theological questions that Greene asks through the proxy of the whiskey priest. the he's necessary as an antagonist and then as a foil for the whiskey priest's ideas, but I think he's also more than his function in the story, and intentionally or not, he jumps off the page more than the plot strictly requires. So I'm curious about how you guys read The Lieutenant, and we can certainly bounce off of The Lieutenant and talk specifically about the priest. I'm sure we will. But The Lieutenant, I don't know. It's definitely too much to say that, like, this is sort of like the, you know, sort of like Satan and or Lucifer in Paradise Lost being just more interesting. But I was really driven and compelled by The Lieutenant as a character, more so than by the priest. And I'm curious if you guys had a similar reaction.
I mean, I don't know that I would say that I was more compelled by the lieutenant than the priest. I thought they were both reasonably complicated, reasonably compelling figures. I mean, So the moment that struck me, this is the second time that I've read this book, but I didn't remember the first time incredibly well, right? And the moment that struck me in rereading is at the moment that the priest is dying, he thinks, being a saint, that's all that matters, right? And then there's this little interaction at the end where there's a family practicing Catholicism in secret, and they hear of the death of the priest, and there's the immediate suggestion that the priest is on his way to martyrdom and sainthood, right? And the fascinating thing about that is the way in which this person whose entire life was lived in this very, feckless, cowardly, ineffective, corrupt manner is allowed to actually gain this status of martyrdom, right? All these things that he's done and thought and said are compressed into this very one-dimensional narrative of martyrdom and sainthood, right? And so I think there's an interesting thematic thing there about complicated people being compressed into simple stories. And the lieutenant, I think, with his different qualities, his different perspectives, his kind of warring selves, mirrors that in a really interesting way. So I think the complexity of the lieutenant is thematically important for that reason, right? Because it one of the ideas of the novel is complicated lives being rendered into simple myths, you know? And so if the priest is this complicated person who's being rendered into the simple myth of the martyr, then the lieutenant is also this complicated person who in turn will be rendered into the simple persona of the Nero figure, right? The executioner.
So the lieutenant being like having dimensions that, you know, kind of complicate the easy reading of someone in his position hunting down priests and killing them. The complication, the kind of moral complexity of the lieutenant is an interesting counterpoint to the complexity of the priest.
It's an interesting counterpoint to the complexity of the priest, again, particularly because one of the ideas of the novel is how these complexities don't survive, right? At least in the nature of figures within the narrative of religion, right? The nature of religion and the way that we think about the histories of religion are that they kind of collapse these figures into these much simpler personas, much simpler stories.
It's so fascinating. I didn't really pick up on and this is my first time reading the novel. Like I definitely see it now, but as I was reading it, I didn't really pick up on the theme as explicitly as you're putting it down, of religion as kind of this, like, organized religion as this function of compression on history, especially as it relates to, like, you know, saints and the priest being, go ahead.
And it's not something that comes into play. I actually didn't see it throughout the novel necessarily, right? It's really just coming into play in the beginning and the ending, in the scenes where the woman is reading the stories of the saints and the martyrs to the son, right? And the way that there's like a story within a story where we hear the mother kind of telling the story of this particular martyr who dies smiling, and the soldiers are so amazed by the beauty of his you know, smile as he enters heaven in his martyring that one of them sops his blood up with a handkerchief to make a holy relic. Mm-hmm. And there's a really obvious contrast there between how that story of being martyred is presented and how the actual experience of, I mean, he is a martyr, right? Even though he doesn't think of himself as a martyr, even though he hasn't lived like a saint, like the priest is in fact seeking, pretty clearly seeking martyrdom as a way of, as you say, kind of regaining his soul, right? And even though his experience of that is not, there's very little relationship between his real experience of that and how it's portrayed. Clearly, like, he's kind of entering that canon now. And so I think making both the lieutenant and the priest complicated characters creates an ironic effect up against seeing how that story almost immediately enters myth. And I don't even know really how much that's meant to be taken as a broader comment on the nature of religion, or how much that's meant to be taken as a broader comment on, I don't know if I can extrapolate that into a larger commentary about how those kinds of stories work more generally, right? But it does seem like, you know, one of the effects of the complexity of the characters of the lieutenant and the priest is to make it more interesting and poignant to see them almost immediately become reduced to these two-dimensional versions of themselves as they enter history and myth.
Patrick, how did you feel about the, because I think that it is useful to maybe just talk about the priest and the lieutenant as counterweights, you know, in this novel. And how did you feel about either or both of them as characters?
Like, I'm definitely finding this a difficult novel to talk about because, you know, I wouldn't say I had a really good grasp on, like, everything that Hans has said about the themes of the novel. That makes total sense. That makes total sense to me. But, like, I guess my head just kept moving in different directions. And, you know, I thought the lieutenant was interesting. I thought the priest was interesting. And I wonder, like, I was thinking of, like, making a joke, like, why do you keep calling the lieutenant the antagonist? Obviously, you know, in the revolution, we should kill the priests. So clearly.
No, Patrick, I'm hoping for that energy in this podcast. I mean, like, don't mute that. I really want. Like, explicitly, I do want to hear from you about this idea that the priest and the lieutenant seem to be kind of like hashing out at the end.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that was definitely an interesting part of the novel where, you know, the lieutenant brings up the crimes of the police, or not the police, the crimes of, you know, how Catholicism in Mexico has developed itself into, like, an upper class, you know? So I definitely thought that was cool. I thought that was a good criticism, but it didn't seem like the novel really developed that theme to anywhere else or too specifically. So I wasn't sure exactly what to say about it. You know, I think that was something that I was really interested in, and the novel needed to mention it just for realism's sake, but it didn't seem like, as you and Hans have been saying, it seems more interested in this idea of martyrdom, in the idea of, you know, human experience as a, you know, a wandering soul embattling the hostile or indifferent environment to regain grace. Like that seems like a very succinct way of putting it, and it wasn't the most interesting aspect of the novel to me.
I mean, I do think it's important that the priest, you can see pretty well that when he existed, and when he briefly is allowed once again to exist within the structure of the church as it existed before the persecution, he sucks, right? Like he almost immediately becomes clearly actually a parasite, right? The novel, even though the novel seems, I mean, my understanding is Graham Greene was a Catholic, even if he struggled a bit with the nature and the meaning of that, right? But like, sure, there's a kind of intuitive sympathy that the novel, I think, has to Catholicism and to faith and to all that, right? But it also freely acknowledges the ways in which the church was acting as a parasite, and the ways in which the priest was quite happy to behave in a parasitic fashion and to kind of reduce his religious experience, reduce his religious presence to this kind of mercenary money grubbing. Right. So, I mean, it's telling, I think, that the good qualities within this man are only allowed to find expression, the conscience of the man, those things are only allowed to find expression outside of the kind of established framework of the church. Now, I don't know that you would necessarily take the whole, I don't know that you would take the whole novel as an implied argument that the church must be corrupt, right? Or that an organized church always has to be corrupt. But I think it's quite happy to acknowledge the ways in which it was in times and places a corrupted and corrupting institution. I think there's actually, it's interesting because I don't think that the novel is sympathetic really either to, I don't think that it's sympathetic to the perspectives of the revolutionaries, and I don't think that it's sympathetic to their quest to eradicate Catholicism or Christianity, but it also doesn't seem particularly sympathetic to the church as it would have existed in Mexico before all this happened, right? I mean, it's in that way, I suppose, it's not particularly thesis-driven. It's interested in this man and how he enters myth, and it's not so much interested in proposing a larger institutional context. And it's kind of, it's, I suppose you could say, and maybe this is, maybe somebody who knew the text better could dismantle this, but it's very interested in individuals and the complexity of individuals, and very distrustful of institutions and ideologies.
I think it's also interested in, even though priests and the institutions of Catholicism inevitably fail to live up to their own ecclesiastical standards, that there is still some value of faith. And you mentioned Graham Greene was a Catholic. He was an agnostic until his adulthood, and then he became a Catholic. And so I think that he has this kind of like one foot in, one foot out distance with the still kind of explicit intention of being sympathetic to the faith itself, and a distrust potentially of the institutions that like develop around that faith. And so that makes it, I think, you know, pretty compelling. And I think that there is something in this that is kind of asking that question too. If you were to kind of like distill all of the faith, all of the Catholicism, all the institutions of Catholicism down to one remaining kind of shitty priest in Tabasco, Mexico, what still is the value of that Catholicism to those people, even if they kind of hate the guy and want him to go, or are kind of bitter toward him or resentful or like, you know, or parasitized when he is sort of haggling with poor folks over how much, you know, they should be charged for him to baptize their children. And he's like, oh, if I charge $1.50, I can get out of here with, like, you know, I could be riding in style. And, you know, I didn't find him too complicated. I think he's interesting. I didn't find him too complicated. I found him to be almost a function of that kind of question. If I were to make this kind of fallible, you know, feckless everyman a vehicle of God, who just nonetheless always sort of lets himself and those around him down with how poorly he performs that function, like, and then explore, you know, these themes through him, you know, that's what I found compelling about him. Not necessarily too much about him that stood out as like a person. I don't know if I could talk about him as a person very well, but I'm curious, kind of, because he brought up like Green's Catholicism, and he lived in Mexico for a time doing research and writing about the persecution of Catholic priests, and later published this novel. And I didn't do a direct comparison, but I read about this novel and those pieces of nonfiction. And apparently there are some kind of like details and scenes that sort of pop up in both. And Hans, you mentioned in an earlier episode how like novels are almost always sort of shaggy assemblages of pieces. And I kind of felt that with this novel. I'm curious too, if there's something in this novel that conveys its more journalistic roots. Is there something that novels with a history in sort of more nonfiction writing can sort of possess a quality, or do you not see that in this? Do you not see that, or do you, you know, maybe another way of looking at it is like, you know, you mentioned Green's own Catholicism. How does Green's own Catholicism potentially manifest in this novel in ways that we haven't talked about already?
I actually found it interesting. The background that you're talking about, where Green had lived in Mexico for a while, and what you describe as the journalistic aspects of the novel, I was not aware of those either time that I read it. And it surprised me a little bit, because it really seems like he hates Mexico. He really makes it seem like an awful place, right? Yeah. And
he was there from like January to May. So it's not like he was there for a long time.
Yeah. And I mean, being a middle class Englishman in and visiting Mexico in the 40s, I'm sure that it would have seemed quite unpleasant, right? Like, just from a material standpoint, like, it probably would have seemed like, I mean, the novel really makes it seem like the entire country, or at least the entire state of Tabasco, it makes it seem like Tabasco is just absolute unmitigated poverty and squalor. And like, almost everybody who lives there is so immiserated as to be almost non-human. And the, you know, the lieutenant, the priest, those are well-sketched characters, right? Those characters feel full in a very literary way. And there are a few, you know, Anglo expats who show up who feel like actual characters. And then pretty much all the, you know, Mexicans and all the indigenous characters really feel much more like something out of a spaghetti Western, right? Like there's a character called the Mestizo, who we haven't talked about at much length, but is the kind of Judas figure of the novel, right? And mm-hmm. he really seems like just a character from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, right? Like this very kind of compressed, grotesque, cartoonish grotesque. And yeah, I mean, it, certainly like the writing has a cinematically vivid quality, and it evokes a sense of being there, but it evokes a sense of being there through the eyes of someone who, again, just regards the whole thing as just awful, right? And it's strange to get that from the viewpoint of someone who, that's his home, you know? Like, even though the priest, I mean, obviously the priest has kind of like fallen from middle class status, right? And you could argue that his sense of the grossness of the place might be influenced by his having fallen from middle class status and having, you know, gone from being an elite to being a refugee. That's reasonable, right? But it does still feel like, you know, we see this place from the viewpoint of someone who has lived there his entire life, but his observations, his sensual relationship to it, those all have the texture of a middle-class Englishman who's just kind of disgusted by the whole thing, you know?
I was just going to say, this really reminds me if we can compare a little bit of how Cormac McCarthy treats Mexico in The Crossing, which you and I talked about, Hans, but Chris, you weren't on that podcast. That was before we combined it all into one. But what I was thinking a lot when I read this was that, wait, so this is about a Mexican priest whose first language is presumably Spanish, and yet, like, do we even have any words of Spanish in this novel? Maybe a few, but, like, mm-hmm. you know, obviously Graham Greene, you know, was English, so he probably didn't speak Spanish, and to me that felt like a something that had aged poorly, which you know. What you're saying, Hans, that like seeing this from the viewpoint that everything is you know, awful and incorrigible poverty and all that, that also seems to age poorly to me. Whereas what's interesting to me a little bit is that in The Crossing by McCarthy, we have something similar, except that the novel seems to do something that this novel doesn't, which is kind of it hints at a deeper culture within Mexico that our main white character, because he's outside of that culture, can't really see. And it's very mysterious to him. It's very far away. And whereas this novel doesn't necessarily hint at a deeper culture that outside of the white perspective, if that makes sense. Is that...
Yeah.
Would you agree with that? I mean, I'm not saying you necessarily have to agree with my characterization of The Crossing, but certainly this novel doesn't seem to think there's anything deeper than this squalor that you're talking about.
I would agree with that, yeah. And I don't remember The Crossing well enough to really make the comparison to The Crossing, but I think that description is accurate, yeah. Okay. It's interesting, Chris, you mentioned the language aspect of it. I have to admit that... Oh, you did. Yeah, you did, yeah. Patrick. You mentioned the language aspect of it, Patrick. While I was reading the novel, I had it in my mind that these were characters. I would periodically think, oh, like these characters ostensibly would be speaking Spanish. But it's written in, as I recall, very idiomatic English, right?
It just
is written as though they were middle class. Like when the priest speaks, he generally speaks as though he were a middle-class English person.
Yeah.
It's probably, given Green's perspective and skill set, it's probably necessary to make feel... like we've talked about the lieutenant and the priest feeling, to their credit, like to Green's credit, like real characters, like 3D fleshed-out people. And I think the fact that they're both speaking idiomatic middle-class English... is a lot of what allows that. And I have to admit, I would periodically think, I wonder what this would have read like in the original. And then I would remember that there was no original, right? This isn't something I'm reading in translation. It's just, and I don't even think that that's, I don't think that's the end of the world necessarily, right? I mean, I think that the, there's, in film at least, there's a pretty long tradition of, you know, characters speaking idiomatically in English when it's understood contextually that in their counterpoints are not going to be, that their counterpoints are speaking in some other language, right? Like, I don't know, like the film The Death of Stalin, right? Like, the characters all speak English in that because it's an English production, and it would make no sense to do the whole thing in subtitles. And there's a richness of characterization that you get from just presenting the thing as though you're listening to native language speech. And I think if we hadn't already observed that the novel kind of really seems to hate Mexico, then I think we would be less inclined to see that as problematic, right?
If that tool
were being used to... Really? Okay.
You know, I just mean that, like, I'm just saying that I didn't necessarily have the feeling that the novel hated Mexico until you pointed it out, and then I was like, oh, duh. But I definitely had the feeling while I was listening that Graham Greene not being a Spanish speaker and not being to me the author felt ill suited to the material he was trying to conquer.
This is an interesting question, actually, because I mean, how do you what's the alternative here, right? I mean, presumably, you know,
I mean, if you can't
he's
do
not
it
gonna
right,
write in Spanish.
Yeah, but if you can't do it right, don't do it.
But wouldn't that be, I don't know, like I've been watching the TV show The Great, right, which is about the Russian, the Catherine the Great and her reign as a Russian empress.
Okay.
And that's all in English, right? It's all English with British accents. Clearly, like, we're to understand that they're speaking Russian, but they just put the whole thing in English. Is that... It would never occur to me to call that problematic, for instance, right? And I don't know if maybe that, so to some extent, maybe that's because we don't think of Russians as the victims of historical marginalization the way that Spanish speakers in Mexico are, or... Yeah. I mean, it's the argument... I'm not sure how you process this without making the assertion that an English speaker should just not write native Spanish-speaking characters, which seems too restrictive to me, right? Like, how would... Can someone tell this story who's not a native Spanish speaker?
Sure. Someone, I mean, like, McCarthy wasn't a native Spanish speaker, and I think he did pretty well in The Crossing dealing with Mexican culture. He's not a native Spanish speaker, but he's clearly a fluent Spanish speaker. And I would say that that's an issue with this novel, that Green is not a fluent Spanish speaker, and being fluent in the language definitely gets you closer to the culture that the language comes from, right? So not that Spanish comes from Spain, but still there's a version of Spanish there's a dialect that's specific to Mexico, obviously.
But The Crossing, and I'll admit I don't remember The Crossing particularly well. Are there any non-Anglo viewpoint characters in The Crossing?
Are there?
My memory of The Crossing is that it's all Anglo viewpoint characters, and that it's all Anglo viewpoint characters, and that anytime somebody would be speaking Spanish, we are given Spanish dialogue, often with no translation.
Right.
Am I remembering those things correctly?
Yes.
So that's.
Go ahead.
I mean, it still seems, though, like the point, it still seems like, I don't think that you could, I think if you were to try to tell this story only from the viewpoint of Anglo characters and only with the Spanish dialogue literally rendered in Spanish, which seems to me, I mean, the extension of your point would seem to be that you can't, I think that, well, I guess I would just kind of come. I mean, I know that you didn't think of the novel as hating Mexico when you read it, right? But I mean, I do think it's pretty clear that there's a basic detachment from the idea of this as an interesting place where people have full lives. And I think that that, and you must have understood on some level when you were reading it that that was part of the idea of the novel, right? And I think that if it were written by someone who thought this was an interesting place where people had full lives, I think we would maybe more easily forgive the fact that, you know, the Spanish is being kind of rendered as idiomatic English. I think that would be, I don't want to agree to the idea that there's no way to, I don't want to agree to the idea that, like, kind of using that technique is wrong. I think it's just, it troubles us more here because of the other ways in which the presentation of Mexico fails.
Okay. I'm not, I wouldn't say that maybe you're right. I'm not sure. I would have to think about it more. I would have to, really, really get down to it. Like, and I think you're probably right that, like, if we still had only, like, this rendered into English characterization idea, but the viewpoint was more sympathetic to Mexico and more sympathetic to the culture, then yeah, we probably would feel less irritated or less disturbed by the narrative viewpoint. But at the same time, if we do that, we're also, like, if we get a viewpoint that is more more sympathetic to Mexico and Mexican life and Mexican culture, we're assuming that's a little, that's somewhat of a different issue from the language thing. Like, and I suppose it is a different issue somewhat. But at the same time, it's a related issue, right? Like, the more...
Well, the issue with the language thing... I think the issue with the language thing is that it keeps the interactions from feeling intuitively authentic, right? The issue with the language thing is that it makes the characters feel maybe like they're not from the environment that they're supposed to be from.
Right, and that's certainly aesthetically problematic. I mean, maybe aesthetics the wrong, but
right.
Technically problematic.
Right. I mean, well, is it technically problematic? Is it aesthetically problematic, or is it ideologically problematic? Right. I mean, I think it's aesthetically problematic to the extent that it disrupts the organic experience of the story, and I think if all of the characters just were well-rounded characters who all spoke and thought in idiomatic English, and maybe if you didn't have Anglo characters, I think that's part of what complicates it, right? Because, like,
there are Anglo characters.
You have Anglo viewpoint characters who speak and think and behave in one way, and then you have viewpoint characters who are ostensibly Mexican but who speak and behave in precisely the same way. I think maybe even if we didn't have... If you didn't have all these Anglo expats hanging around at the beginning and ending of the novel, I think maybe we would then also be less aware of the oddity that there's no distinction between how these Anglo characters speak and think and how the Mexican characters speak and think. And I think that's probably more an aesthetic issue than it is an ideological one. Now, the ideological question of, right, is it inappropriate for Graham Greene to tell this story? That's something we've talked about a little bit. I think I can't remember what episode it was, and it might not be an episode that hasn't aired at the time that this is airing. But the one issue that you and I kind of talked about on a couple episodes ago was, you know, if you're writing a character outside of your own identity, what should be the limits on that, right? Mm-hmm. And your perspective then was that essentially, as I, and maybe I'm distorting it, but my memory of your perspective is that it's okay for authors to write characters outside of their own identity set. And ultimately, right, it's your job as an author to be as ambitious as possible in expanding the scope of how you can encompass and understand the human experience, which might very well involve writing outside of your own identity set. And it's to some extent kind of the job of editors and publishers and readers to then judge that and to render on how well that's been done or not done.
Right.
But the idea that as an author you should restrain yourself from that for ideological reasons ultimately is limiting, unnecessarily limiting. I mean, my memory is that that was your perspective.
I agree, that's my perspective. So I'm not necessarily saying that Green should have been like, oh, I can't do this for ideological reasons. But I do think that if you're going to write outside your perspective, you have to like do it as well as you can. And maybe this is as well as you can, but it's not super good, right?
That's fair. Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
I'm going to jump in because as well as you can, I think some of the things that you're talking about, I think what they're a little bit reinforced by Green wanting to tell a certain kind of story, right? So I think that that is one of the forces at work here, where I have as one of my questions abandonment as a recurring theme. I think the word abandonment appears several times throughout the novel. And I think, you know, maybe Green hated Mexico. Maybe he didn't. But he certainly had this very fascinating premise of a place in which a religion to which he belongs and to which, you know, a decent amount of his readership would at least be sympathetic, has been outlawed. And then you have this kind of almost post-apocalyptic like sort of space. And I think that he wanted that. I think he wanted that to be one of the undercurrents of the novel. And if you want to kind of like push kind of the fabric of a place and a people into that, you know, sort of like fallen, like kind of grotesque, very sad, melancholic, listless, you know, like space, if you want to push everyone into that space, it's hard to also humanize them, especially if you don't like, I think that that's a tightrope. But I think that that's kind of the story that he wants to tell. And in a way, from our perspective, with just more like sympathy to how different cultures are portrayed. And when you say doing as well as he could, Patrick, I don't think that probably his contemporary readership was all that bothered. Now we have different, expectations. And I think that, you know, one of his motives was to really, I think one of the things that I sense that he really wanted to do was take this very fascinating premise for this space and these people and the things that they're driving out of their lives, and to just sort of like turn to really exaggerate that. And in a way, it makes the novel not age very well.
Right.
Because it turns these people into a caricature of just like despair, and which reinforces a lot of things about like, you know, American, European, potentially perceptions of Mexico that are problematic.
I mean, and I suppose it's not as though there, I would imagine there was probably a great deal of poverty and despair in rural Mexico in the 1930s, right? That's not unfair.
Right.
But the level to which there mostly doesn't seem to be any other texture to daily life.
Yeah.
Just feels just feels shallow, you know.
Maybe that's why the dentist exists as a character, just as like a token, like, hey, Europeans are shitty too. Here's this like wandering drug-addled dentist that, you know, is completely ineffectual and like has probably one of the most gross sounding operating, or what do you call it, an operating room, dental examination rooms that you could, that you'd ever heard of.
Yeah. Well, but he's at least, he does feel, again, you know, more like a fleshed out character,
real.
Though, despite his very brief appearance in the novel. And I did enjoy reading this, and, you know, on a sentence level, it is very well crafted, and I've mostly just been bashing it, and I don't mean to, I hope that doesn't come across as too one-dimensional, you know, but, like, there's we start with the dentist, if I remember right. I think he's the first thing that we see in the novel, and there's a reference to his being a child and finding an old pair of dentures in his father's trash, and just immediately... there's a paragraph that talks about him finding an old pair of dentures and thinking, I want to be a dentist. And it says something like, how amazing, we should be thankful we cannot see the horrors and degradations lying around our childhood in cupboards and bookshelves everywhere. That's great. That's great, right? His first memory was finding a discarded cast in a waste paper basket, the rough, toothless, gaping mouth of clay. It had been his favorite toy. They tried to tempt him with Meccano, but fate had struck. There's always one moment in childhood when the door opens and lets the future in. Oh, that's lovely, right? That's good. That's good writing. And
he's great on a line level.
He is quite often great on a line level.
He reminded me at times, actually, and I didn't underline any of these passages. It occurred to me to, and I never did, because I was reading it on a PDF on my phone. And it was just too much of a pain in the ass to do that. But a couple lines sort of kind of felt DeLillo-esque in that they didn't really mean anything to me. Like, they were just like, they just sounded amazing. Sometimes DeLillo does that too, right? Where like, he's just kind of freelancing a little bit, allowing himself to drift. And I don't know, the some of these lines, they're, like, it's a interesting, Graham feels very precise almost all of the time. And then sometimes it feels like he peppers in these poetic passages that sometimes, like, are, you know, precise, and sometimes they feel loose in a kind of a creative way that I enjoyed too. And again, that reminded me of DeLillo.
It's interesting that you mentioned DeLillo, actually, because in some ways, even though DeLillo is much less explicit about it, they're both what you might call agnostic Catholics, right? I mean, DeLillo, I don't think literally believes in the factual reality of Christianity, but he's culturally a Catholic, and he's actually, if you look at his body of work, almost any time nuns come in or priests come in or the church comes in, they're actually often portrayed in very positive lights, right? He has this instinctive sympathy to Catholicism that is really at odds with the idea that people have of him as this sort of postmodern nihilist, right? I mean, if anything, I think he's very, very critical of the state of postmodern nihilism, and his affection for the church and its symbols and its agents is probably the strongest way in which that's expressed, and often the most odd. You know, I was thinking about this. Mm-hmm. There's the lieutenant. There's I might even have highlighted this. I'm going to see if I can try to find it. There's a passage where the lieutenant is thinking about it, it's just kind of the lieutenant's internal monologue, right? And he's thinking about, it says something like, he wished for all the children to have a cooling earth and a meaningless life. And it was just like, I remember reading that and thinking, I felt a little bit of the same irritation that I felt when we were reading Flannery O'Connor, where it's like, these fucking Catholic literary novelists just can't do a compelling representation of atheistic thought, right? Like, all their atheists are these weird kind of reductive caricatures. And the lieutenant, to be fair, in his kind of fleshed outness as a person, in many ways is not. But I had a little bit of the irritation that I did with Flannery O'Connor, where, like, and I think actually, like, Green is much better than Flannery O'Connor in this regard, right? Like, when I read Wiseblood, which I think we did for the podcast, right? Wiseblood, I was actively angry at how how poorly she was just able to conceive of the idea of atheism as a freestanding philosophical system. For the most part, Green doesn't really try and succeeds, I suppose, just by virtue of, you know, not doing that. But there was the occasional line that had that same sort of quality. I don't know. That was a little bit of a free association there. I don't know that it had any point to it other than just... It's interesting to think about the relationship between Catholicism and 20th century literary fiction, right? Like, roughly maybe the 40s to the 80s, there's an interesting kind of, there's actually a fair amount of, like, Catholicism, I think, is much more present and much more sympathetically rendered and much more ambiguously rendered at the same time than something like, for instance, evangelical Christianity or... I don't know. Well, those are, you know, most of the two things you'd be seeing in at least American fiction.
I just didn't get the story I wanted from this. That's all.
You didn't get the story that you wanted?
Yeah. Like, I agree with everything that's being said. Like, the, you know, on the sentence level, Green is decent. Pretty good. Obviously, Flannery O'Connor sucks. So I agree with that.
we were pretty hard on her in the Wiseblood episode.
It was not good. Like, I remember you saying, like, she just doesn't seem to care about humans. Like, she seems to think they suck. And, you know, she doesn't seem to have any sympathy for people outside of her scope. But that's not the case with Green. Green definitely, like, even though he's seemingly not interested in the questions that I would find most interesting, he, you know, it's not like the lieutenant is just some kind of faceless bad guy. Like, he gets his moment to say what he believes, and it's not like the novel is condemning him. And, you know, so I guess, you know, there is a lot to think that there is a lot that's good about this novel. I stand by thinking that Green didn't do so well at, like, inhabiting the viewpoints that he needed to inhabit, which is, you know, the Mexican viewpoint.
Yeah, I agree.
But, man, I just kept thinking while I was listening to this, man, this would have been great if Orwell had written this book. This would have been just fantastic, you know, because
Orwell would have, because it feels like the question at the end, or one of the questions is, or one of the things that the priest and the lieutenant are debating is the lieutenant wants to make change in this life,
right,
to save people now, and the priest is saying that's like, no matter what we do, you know, everyone will still, people will still suffer. And in the priest's argument is the argument for faith,
right,
and in the lieutenant's argument is the argument, like, for why faith is actually actively obstructing solutions to you know, poverty and,
right.
You know, and human suffering. So it really does feel like Orwell would write this, but he'd write it from the other perspective.
Yeah. Well, what made me really think about why Orwell would have written this in a way, obviously for me, he would have made it better, but that's not like an objective thing that you could say, like, you know, he objectively would have written it better. But, See, like, what I like about Orwell is that he's good at saying, look, the frickin' red menace of, like, the Soviets and Chinese communism were horrible. Like, this is horrible, horrible shit. And they murdered a bunch of people, and they pressed the boot on human faces, and they're awful. But he always does that from the perspective of a socialist. So, like, at the end of Animal Farm, you know, to point out how horrible the Napoleon, who's a representation of Stalin, Napoleon the Pig is Stalin, to point out how horrible Napoleon is, the animals that see him through the window can't tell the difference between him, a pig, and a man who represents capitalists. So, like, to tell you how horrible Napoleon is, Stalin is, well, he's as bad as the capitalists. So, you know, he always did it from he always criticized the Soviet Union and other authoritarian versions of communism from a socialist perspective, which I thought would have been really cool here, because, like, there are real problems with the Mexican Revolution and things that the Red Shirts did, you know, not on the same scale as you know, the Soviet Union and China, obviously, because it was a smaller thing. But, you know, Orwell would have pointed these things out and said, look, you know, yeah, the priests were horrible, but so were the communists here. And I think that perspective would have treated the subject matter really well, especially because Orwell also had an interesting vision, like an interesting relationship with Catholicism. Well, he was agnostic Anglican, but Anglicanism and Catholicism are related and intertwined. But yeah, that's just me on a rant with no, maybe nothing solid to say about the novel, other than, you know, we could have had a slightly different perspective that I would have enjoyed more, but that's it.
I think you can actually get something, you know, out of what you said though, Patrick, which is, you know, one of my questions, my last question, I'll say, and we've talked about this already, it concerns things that have aged poorly and things that have aged well. And I do actually think it's fair. It changes the entire nature of the novel, but,
right?
But it's fair to say that that socialism as an instrument for dismantling Catholicism and faith is less interesting or compelling today than socialism and capitalism. Like, basically, sure. Like, I'm thinking that this is, you know, in the 40s, a very, very fascinating concept of a political system standing in opposition to right. You know, a Western religion, the Western
right,
religion.
Right, right.
And that, you know, like, and that's that, I think that actually arose again in Soviet Union too, correct? Like, basically,
yeah, like,
it's not an uncommon,
it was this
socialist
weird
paradigm.
Yeah, it was this weird Leninist idea that, you know, so Marx is like, religion is the opening of the masses. So Lenin's like, oh, okay, let's kill all the religious people, and, you know,
yeah.
Like, it's this crazy authoritarian bullshit. Like, I'm an atheist, and I don't see why as a socialist we need to do anything about religion except make sure that, like, priests or whoever, the elite, aren't you know, exploiting people. That's all I would care about, right?
So, and I just said, yeah. And that's just a less interesting conflict than the, you know, than socialism, capitalism, or various like more like we're just less religious these days,
right?
And so that's an aspect of the novel that doesn't age
that
as
well.
Yeah. I mean, like maybe
interesting point
if we were Catholic, but well, it's your point, Patrick. I'm just rephrasing it. But I am curious. We've already talked about a couple of things that age poorly. The kind of the handling of the Mexican people and Mexico as a place, and if this does have journalistic roots, it's problematic, especially so that, like, you know, someone who had invested time in this place would kind of use it, I think, to portray basically, like, Mexico is the is an apocalyptic hellscape, and that doesn't age very well. But are there other things that age poorly?
I mean, I think if anything, the idea that there was some authority that was given to Green by living there for a few months, right, is,
yeah,
it's like a kind of it's an unearned authority, right? It's an unearned authority that now I think we would be much more inclined to question. And I mean, well, it's now and here we are questioning it. So I guess that's not a particularly clever thing to say, right? But like, I think the pose of the journalist as the use of the pose of the journalist to kind of gain an authority that is in fact abused, I think, has not aged particularly well. One thing that
That's
I would say
point.
Has aged quite well, actually, is the, and again, it's really only something that kind of comes in at the end, but it is so interesting when it does come in, the idea of figures being simplified into heroes and villains as they enter myth, right? The idea of this very complex character who, for the most part, almost never does the right thing, through one key decision at one moment, being simplified into eventually a martyr and a saint. I think that feels very plausible, and that feels like a phenomenon that we see even now, right? Like that will just be part
like
of how
in novels that are written now and movies that are written now.
No, yes, in novels and movies that are written now, but just generally in the ways in which discourse wants to reduce people to villains and heroes,
absolutely.
Right? Like
anyone
who, and it happens in a much more compressed way, and also in a way where an attentive person maybe can pick it apart a little bit better, but the nature of current discourse is very interested in heroizing and villainizing, right? And, and I think that instinct is portrayed well here. And I think that's actually a wise, even though it's maybe not a key part of the overall action of the novel, I think when it does appear, it's a very wise and clever insight. And honestly, one that
to some extent,
I don't think it redeems the other faults of the novel, but I think that it gives the whole thing. I think if that bit didn't come in at the end, I would have a significantly less positive feeling about the overall work, even though, again, it's kind of minor and in passing at the conclusion.
Just so I understand what you're saying, Hans, like, so you think that the novel is actually critiquing the simplification, at least at the end, in passing, it's critiquing the simplification of people into, like, categories?
I don't know necessarily that it's wanting to critique it or endorse it. I think it's just acknowledging it.
It notices it.
And that's one thing
that
I appreciate about it, right?
Huh.
It notices that it happens, and it allows us to consider whether that is what the trade-offs of that are, right? It notices that it happens, and surely, given the level of effort that seems to have gone into making well-rounded individuals of the lieutenant and the priest, surely there's just the fact that that was done implies a certain amount of endorsement of the well-roundedness of people and understanding the well-roundedness of people. And yet, at the same time, I think there's a way in which probably the novel understands that, like, the ideal of sainthood is very inspiring and helpful to the priest, right? The ideal of the saints and the martyrs gives him a way to make meaning of his own life. And yet, at the same time, the idea of saints and martyrs is, in fact, a collapsing and a flattening of the fullness of humanity, which is something that Green must appreciate to the extent that he took the trouble to make the priest and the lieutenant fully rounded characters, right? Mm.
Sure.
So it's not really, it's an understanding, I think, of the trade-offs of that without necessarily endorsing or critiquing it. I think that
sounds like a critique to me.
Maybe so, maybe so. but not necessarily a full-throated critique.
Well,
it's a textured, nuanced critique.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply that, like, he's not being nuanced, but, like, the well-roundedness of the characters compared to the flattening and simplification that is inherent in heroizing someone, that it seems like the well-roundedness is what the author prefers, and that is at least a small critique, right? Or not?
Yeah, although I don't think that we should underestimate how much, you know, and to some extent I'm repeating myself here, right? But, like, the ideal of sainthood and martyrdom, that is what allows the priest to redeem himself.
That's true.
Right?
That's true. Okay. So it is.
It's not valueless for those concepts to exist in the world of the novel.
Right. Okay. I withdraw. You win. You're correct.
But I mean, I think I think it understands that trade-off, right?
Sure.
And it understands that, certainly it understands that something is lost in that transition, you know? Certainly it understands that there's a tragedy, I think, actually, in that flattening and that transition from full humanity into simplified myth. Mm-hmm. There's a value to myth, but there's a loss in that transition.
Do you think that it's an aspect of dehumanization that these, like, figures exist that have unattainable qualities that you're nonetheless expected, you know, to emulate even though it's impossible? And then the great joke at the end is that you're mistaken for having reached that, you know, unattainable level after you've been shot in the street by police?
That's an interesting question. Maybe? I don't know. I'd have to think about that a bit longer to definitively say whether I agree with it or not. I mean, to call it a great joke is, I'm not sure how I feel about that. That might actually sum it up perfectly, or that might be a distortion. I don't know for sure.
I'll say I really enjoyed reading it. I think that it does have some real, like, limits. Like, it would be a really interesting, like, I don't know exactly what the course would be, but if you were looking for something that was written really well but then is kind of transparent in the things about it that, you know, are also failures that have to do with some, you know, in some cases with its age. In other cases, you know, maybe they've always been shortcomings of the text. I think this is a really good example of something that is, like, crafted really well, and I respect it and I enjoyed it. And then, and I found it even at times kind of really profound. And then at the end, I still, you know, acknowledge real problems with it. But it sounds like, Hans, you're somewhere similar.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I appreciated a lot of the sentence-level writing. I thought some of the characterization had great depth to it. I like, you know, to the extent that it comes to an interesting thematic place, like we've talked about, I do appreciate that about it. I'm honestly not... I mean, I've been very critical of it as... I've been very critical of the way that it relates to the place that it's portraying. I don't find that insufferable, right? I can imagine somebody else finding it very insufferable. It's not really something I have an emotional response to, actually. I'm not viscerally offended by it. I can imagine somebody else being viscerally offended by it. But, I mean, I can recognize it as it's an aesthetic flaw and probably an ideological flaw, but not an unforgivable one. I mean, I will admit, I don't know how much the point of the podcast should be this kind of thing, but like, I wouldn't say that I loved it. You know, I was not profoundly moved by it. I was not, I probably won't be that excited to read it again. I mean, I don't think that it's an enduring classic for the ages or a marvelous book, but I think it's perhaps, I don't know if it really, I don't necessarily know how much of a reputation it has at this point. It might be overrated, but I don't know for sure what level of rated it actually is right now. But it's certainly a book with strong aspects to recommend it and obvious failures. And all things considered, I suppose, I mean, a white English guy in the 40s writing about a totally different place and culture, I suppose, has things to recommend it and has obvious failures, is probably for the most part about as good as you would really expect to do. So maybe Orwell could beat it in that regard. You know, maybe I'm setting the bar too low, but
Did Orwell speak Spanish or the Mexican dialect of Spanish?
No,
Patrick.
No,
if he didn't, then I don't want to fucking hear about him writing this novel.
Yeah, he wouldn't have written this novel because he was extremely English. He pretty much stuck to English things.
Sounds kind of questionable to me.
And it seems actually, from what I know about other novels by Graham Greene, it seems a little bit unusual to his normal pattern to be writing. It's unusual for him to be writing as a non-English character. I mean, I think we've all read The Heart of the Matter, and that is taking place in a foreign area, but it's primarily or entirely, I think, from the viewpoint of English expats. And I've also read The End of the Affair, which is I did not enjoy, but The End of the Affair, I mean, it just takes place in England, so obviously it's all, you know, from English perspectives. But
I did want to note, assuming that we're kind of wrapping up, I did want to make sure to mention this to specifically Audible listeners. I don't know if there is another audiobook out there of this book, but there's only one available on Audible, and it's horrible. It really no, I mean, you're laughing, but it really made my experience of this worse and made me really wish that there were another audiobook or that I had read this. And I think I would have enjoyed it a little more. Like, I still could, like, understand the main narrative and the main flow and, like, get some of the main ideas that we've been talking about, but like the narrator, like, his voice was fine, but the production was awful. Like, sibilants were unchecked. It sounded like a snake hissing every other second. And it also sounded like someone was like, let's do an experiment. Let's add a bunch of fuzz to the audio. Like, let's run it through a fuzz pedal, but then put noise reduction on it so it's all distorted and wonky, but somehow intelligible. Yeah, that's what it was like. It was not a good production. So a note to Audible listeners, try to ingest this book in some other way.
Well, you've heard it here, folks. This shitty Audible book, potentially okay read, the traditional way. Thank you for talking about The Power and the Glory with me, guys. Hans, what are we doing next?
Yeah, so my pick for next time is actually a novel translated from Spanish, which is The Garden of Seven Twilights by Miquel de Polo.
God, it's a great title. I have no idea what it means, but...
And I have not read this, full disclosure. It's one of those times when I pick something that I have not personally read, but it's a novel I've been interested in reading.
Oh, damn it, Hans. It's, when you do that, it always goes wrong. That's a,
what examples are you thinking
of? I'm just fucking with you. It's not true. It's not true.
I feel like I haven't done it in a while. I'm trying to remember what the last thing was that I picked that we hadn't read. I think the last thing we picked that I hadn't read was Checkout 19. And I did, to be fair, when I was editing the Checkout 19 episode, I remember thinking, like, I hope Claire Louise Bennett doesn't listen to this, because we're doing a really bad job of discussing this book.
No, I thought like 80% of it is good. I think it was the one before that, the Namwali Sirpel you said you hadn't read, which I wasn't a huge fan of that. Not that it was bad, but.
Well, I mean, I think we did a pretty decent job of discussing The Furrows. I liked Checkout 19 more, but I thought we did a worse job of turning it into a podcast discussion. But anyway. Garden of Seven Twilights.
All right, cool.
This has got like a, it's got like a diagram in the front of the novel with like, with, it's like, this is kind of Leaves of Grassy, isn't it?
Oh, that's crazy.
Leaves of Grass? You mean House of Leaves?
Oh, no, House of Leaves, not Leaves of Grass. That's Walt Whitman. House of Leavesy, isn't it?
It's, I think it might be structurally somewhat complicated. I may experience regret.
it'll be great.
Yeah, I look forward to it.
Me too.
Thank you guys. Thank you for joining me on this. Thank you for discussing this. Thank you for listening, everybody. And we'll catch you next time.